Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the state of Utah is sued over how it provides public defenders. A longtime ultra-conservative leader in the state wants the GOP to dump Trump. Polling shows an advantage for incumbent Senator Mike Lee against either of his potential Democratic challengers. Wanted posters are distributed as a polygamist leader goes on the run. And the FBI arrests a Utah man who they say wanted to blow up BLM property. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Matt Canham. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Also, Justice reporter Jessica Miller is here with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Government editor Dan Harry is with us as well. Dan, good morning. Welcome.
Hi, Roger.
And joining us via the phone is Justice reporter Nate Carlisle. Nate, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And listeners, you can join this conversation as well. What caught your attention from this past week's news? Put your comments and questions in the comments section at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Justice reporter Nate Carlisle, I know your time is limited this morning, and so let's kick things off with a story that you've been following all this week, and that is the disappearance of polygamist leader Lyle Jeffs, who was free pending trial in a food stamp fraud case. Nate, first off, Jeffs wasn't actually, I guess, free. He was under house arrest or home confinement. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. He was living in a house in Salt Lake County with a GPS ankle monitor.
And then tell us what happened here. I guess he's gone on the run. How did that happen?
Sometime Sunday, the federal authorities that were monitoring him apparently went to his home, and he was not there. The ankle monitor was somehow disabled or taken off, and that day a judge issued a warrant for his arrest.
Hmm. And there's been some criticism from former members of his community, the FLDS Church, who say that this was a predictable outcome, I guess. Is that true?
Yes. There are a lot of people upset about this in Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona. A lot of people down there, his former followers, submitted affidavits or even testified in some of the detention hearings that this was someone with a lot of means, that he would flee, that he helped his brother Warren Jeffs evade law enforcement 10 years earlier. And a lot of people are upset that he did just what they told the judge he would do.
Well, and you mentioned that his brother Warren, this is somebody who was on the run for years himself. He was eventually captured in Las Vegas before he was convicted of multiple counts of sexual assault involving the underage girls that he took as brides. In your reporting, you describe FLDS safe houses, the support that Warren Jeffs had access to while he was on the run. Is Lyle Jeffs getting that kind of help right now?
Well, I mean, we don't know for sure because we haven't found him yet. But certainly in the last 12 or 13 years, the FLDS has a history of using these network of safe houses, and we actually have an article running over this weekend about how that network works. But in short, they'll buy or rent houses in anywhere, Texas, Colorado, South Dakota, Idaho, and there'll be kind of way stations where people can hide out from law enforcement for days, weeks, months. Then also the FLDS has a relatively sophisticated network of burner phones, and people will call one burner phone, and then they'll use intercom systems to patch them through to used to be Warren, now might be Lyle. We're all kind of speculating just how Lyle's going to stay on the run, but this history with Warren gives us some clues.
You know, it's worth noting that that in this case, this is a food stamp fraud case, and I'm going to ask you to remind us what it's about. But polygamy itself isn't actually part of this case, despite the fact that it's illegal. It's difficult to prosecute. What is this case about?
Well, you're right that he's not charged with bigamy or polygamy itself. He's charged with two counts related to a food stamp fraud. They're conspiracy counts or attempted conspiracy counts to defraud the government and to launder money. He and 10 co-defendants are accused of taking food stamp debit cards from FLDS followers, turning them into the church, and then either using those cards at businesses to get money. I mean, legitimate businesses, you know, Costco, Walmart, stuff like that, and to buy groceries and bring them back to the FLDS storehouse. Or they would take the debit cards to some grocers controlled by the FLDS. Those grocers would run the cards, and then they get cash reimbursements. So they would just keep the cash reimbursements or turn the cash into the church.
I'm going to throw out a quick reminder to our listeners that you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-8255. That's 355-TALK. You know, on Tuesday, Nate, the FBI issued a wanted poster. I've got a copy of it here in front of me, and it says that Jeffs should be considered armed and dangerous, and that if you have any information concerning this person, please contact your local FBI office or the nearest American embassy or consulate. And that last part, Nate, makes me wonder, could Jeffs be outside of the country?
It's possible. I mean, the FLDS does have an enclave in British Columbia. They're said to have some properties in Mexico and South America. I mean, again, this was a concern when Warren was on the run, too, that he'd go to a neighboring country. For what it's worth, Warren never did. He stayed in the United States. Now, Lyle is not necessarily Warren, so maybe he will go internationally. I should point out, too, that one theory on why Lyle ran is not that he was worried about the food stamp fraud case, for which he may only face a couple of years in prison. He may have ran because of everything else that's going on with the FLDS. You know, there's still an active task force investigating the sect, and Lyle's accused of other crimes, money laundering, child sex abuse, child sex trafficking, banking fraud. I mean, all this stuff he's been accused of over the years, but never charged with. He may have worried that there was another indictment coming down, one that was a lot more serious, and that's why he took off.
This was just the start of a great deal more charges being brought against him.
Correct.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and really it's a series of stories on this case going back a long way, all of it available at sltrib.com. Justice reporter Nate Carlisle, I know you've got places to be this morning, and so we're going to let you go, but thanks very much for this report.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, we hope that you will stay with us for a bit longer as well. There's a great deal to cover on the program. Give us a call, 801-355-TALK, or comment at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. Well, we just heard from Justice reporter Nate Carlisle about Lyle Jeffs going on the lam. Let's stay with the Justice Desk for a bit longer. Jessica Miller, you reported this week that the ACLU of Utah is suing the state of Utah over its system of public defenders. These are the lawyers provided to people who can't afford their own counsel. What is this lawsuit all about?
Okay, well, I guess we could start at the beginning. In the United States, you have the right to a lawyer if you can't afford one. That's in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the states are kind of responsible for meeting that constitutional obligation. And Utah is one of two states in the nation that have delegated that responsibility to the counties, basically said, you all can take care of it. This is your own thing. So far, there's been no state oversight. There's been no one to say, well, you're not doing it right. You know, you've got these flat fee contracts and these attorneys aren't being paid enough. It's just been everyone's on their own.
Each county.
Each county's on their own, and they all handle it a little differently. There's a couple of counties, Salt Lake and Utah County, they have nonprofit public defender offices, but most of the counties rely on contracts with attorneys.
And so depending on the county in question, the quality of that defense can vary pretty wildly, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. And so the ACLU and there was even a state task force that's been studying this for a really long time, and they've come up with all these problems, you know, that there's this these problems with attorneys getting these flat fees. They've got this huge caseload. They can't ask for funding for private investigators, experts, things like that. So at the last legislative session, they set aside $2 million to set up this this Indigent Defense Commission. And the ACLU said, well, that's not enough. You haven't done enough to address these issues. And so now they filed this lawsuit. And in that lawsuit, they're just asking that, at this point, just asking for a judge to declare this uh, this indigent offense unconstitutional.
And there are various plaintiffs in this case. These are people who the ACLU says were harmed by the system. What do we know about these plaintiffs?
So there's six plaintiffs. They're all in the jails right now. There's three different jails that they're in. And they're kind of just like normal guys. I mean, they're not, they've got, you know, some burglary charges, theft, just a couple drug charges. They're not, you know, murderers or anything like that. They're just guys sitting in jail waiting for to talk to their public defenders. They've been arrested, they've been charged, but they haven't gone to court. They haven't met their public defender. If they have, it's been like for 5 minutes or less.
So you mentioned that lawmakers created this commission to look at indigent defense in Utah during this last legislative session. How are lawmakers and the state responding to this lawsuit from the ACLU?
Mostly, they just wish that the ACLU would have waited for a longer period of time. You know, it's only been 3 months. And as Todd Weiler, who was the legislator who sponsored this, he said, you know, we've only decided these panel members last week. You know, it's been very slow, I guess, to start. And so now they've got these panel members in place, or commission members in place, and now they're trying to figure out where to go from here, where to start, and then ACLU comes and files his lawsuit.
What does the ACLU say about that argument, that there, you know, there should have been more time allowed for the state to consider this, or to have its own commission look at this?
Well, they've been, you know, kind of making a stink about this for years, and so they're saying, well, you know, we've been waiting here long enough. We waited for this legislative session that wasn't sufficient, and, you know, in the meantime, there's, you know, all these defendants going, not just these six guys, but there's, you know, hundreds of people going through the court system every day, and, you know, their rights are being violated. That's the ACLU's position.
Are there, I mean, you said that Utah is one of two states that has that isn't under a state-run system of public defenders. I guess there are probably models out there that the state could consider if it wanted to go the route of taking control of this. And that's probably something that the commission would look at. But in the meantime,
right,
this lawsuit goes forward.
Yeah, yeah. There's, I mean, everyone does it a little differently. Some of them have, you know, state-run. Some of them have county-run but have a state-run, you know, oversight.
Right.
And so that's what's kind of missing so far.
Well, I feel like we need someone from the opinion desk here. Was this lawsuit premature? Was it overdue? But I've only got non-partial reporters here. Although I do have Dan Harry.
I'll try to comment on that impartially, and that is that Jessica's right. I mean, this is something that the ACLU has been warning about for years. And I think what they did was the judiciary study had their own study done. And they concluded, basically, they were right. You know, they were violating people's constitutional rights. And so they kind of gave them this last legislative session and said, okay, now you either put up or shut up. And they didn't. They put up some. But unlike many things in politics, you can't sort of compromise on constitutional rights. And that's what they basically said. And they said, okay, you didn't do what you needed to do. So now we have no alternative but to sue.
Okay. Dan Harry filling us in. It didn't go far enough from the mindset of the ACLU, these lawyers. This lawsuit goes forward now. Jessica Miller, what can we expect to happen next, I guess?
That's a good question. I mean, at this point, they're just asking that a judge declare this process unconstitutional. And, you know, if they do that, where they go from here, I'm not exactly sure. I asked them that, and they just said, you know, we want some changes made. We want, you know, they're not saying it's going to be an easy fix. You can't just say, oh, well, let's throw a bunch of money at it. I mean, there's a lot of problems. They're very complicated. And so where we go from, if they declare it's unconstitutional, the judge, where we go from here, I'm not sure it's exactly clear yet, or not clear to me, I guess.
Yet to be determined as well.
Right.
Listeners, if you want to comment on this or any of the stories that we are currently discussing, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. Coming up, the attempted bombing of a BLM cabin, and of course, politics. Right now, we're going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah State University Alumni Association's Aggie Desk Plate. Aggie Desk Plates show Aggie pride and support student scholarships at USU. More information at alumni.usu.edu.
It has been a hectic time for business owners across the UK thinking about what is next for their bottom line.
We offer luxury clothing at an accessible price point, and we would no longer be able to do so, I don't think. My business would probably be gone after a few months.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fallout, whatever it is, from the Brexit vote next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Matt Canham, and by editor Dan Harry. And we are digging into this past week's news. Again, you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or by calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. I'm going to keep with the Justice Desk for just a moment longer, and then we will get to politics and other stories. But Jessica, another story from that beat, news that broke yesterday that your colleague Matthew Piper reported on, a Tooele County man who was arrested on Wednesday after he tried to blow up a Federal Bureau of Land Management cabin, I guess it was. What happened with this story?
Yeah, so he apparently, or allegedly, placed a pipe bomb against the door of a cabin and along the Arizona Strip, and you know, pushed the button to detonate it, and nothing happened. Apparently, he had recruited an undercover FBI agent to build the bomb.
And the FBI had essentially infiltrated his network. He was a militia leader of sorts, I guess, and he was a friend of Robert Lavoie Finicum, who was killed during this standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Sanctuary in Oregon. He was also connected, I understand, to Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So the FBI caught Keebler because they were right there with him. Undercover agents had infiltrated this militia. How did this play out? I guess he's arrested and now, being considered for these charges.
Yeah, he was arrested Wednesday morning, Nephi, and then he made his court appearance the next day. He's charged with attempting to blow up this property. And so if he's convicted of this, he faces 5 to 20 years in federal prison.
Okay. And I understand this is just one part of the story that I found interesting, that he had considered placing an explosive device of some sort, apparently, according to these charging documents, at a BLM office in Salt Lake City, but then, I guess, reconsidered and looked for a more remote target.
Yes, apparently there was, the BLM office in Salt Lake City is at the Gateway, and so there's the mall and the homeless shelters right across the street. And so apparently, according to these charges, he decided that because of the homeless population, because it was commercial property, they decided to go somewhere else. Apparently, at this point, he did not want to actually harm people, but he did want to blow up a building, allegedly.
Make a statement. Editor Dan Harry, I'd love to bring you in on this as well. The FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in Salt Lake City led this investigation. Law enforcement is taking very seriously these sorts of strains of revolt in the Western United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fear is that this has reached some sort of tipping point where what we've seen in Malheur and the Cliven Bundy Ranch a couple of years ago is starting to grow, that they're getting recruits, that the sort of frustration in parts of rural Utah and other areas of the West has grown to the point where, you know, we really could start seeing more and more of these kind of violent activities as a form of protest. Mm-hmm. And some criticism has been leveled at our political leaders for really not coming out and disavowing this and condemning it more strongly than they have. You know, anytime they receive that criticism, they dismiss it as ridiculous and, you know, say they're not encouraging that. But, you know, some of the words that they use at times have been intended, I think, to incite political passion. And sometimes those words can be viewed as inflammatory.
Whatever the intent may have been originally.
Yeah.
Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this story. Give us a call, 801-355-TALK, with your questions or comments. You can join us on air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment at sltrib.com. SFPN.com. A really interesting story by Matt Piper on this arrest, all available at SLTrib.com. You know, we normally start the show off with politics. Today I'm putting it off till the very last moment. So, Matt Canham, you're going to have to wait just a little bit longer over there in the corner. Dan Harry, I'll stay with you. The Utah Transit Authority has approved funding for an extension of tracks at the Salt Lake City International Airport. But that's not without some objections. Tell us about this project and its cost.
Well, what they've approved actually is just sort of a design study. Look at a much more expensive and extensive proposal. It's actually only, the plan is to extend the tracks line at the airport only 0.5 mile. But it's tremendously expensive. It's $65 million is the estimated cost. Well, why is it so expensive? Because they need to elevate the tracks so that it can go to the new terminal that's being built out there. And so the money right now, the UTA has not committed to doing this project. They have committed $4.2 million just to look at it, to study it, and do a design work on it. They approved that, however, quite quickly. Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski was on board with it. The Salt Lake Chamber was on board with it. And they all see this as, if you don't do this, you're going to have a tracks line that ends like 1,200 yards from the end of the terminal. So as you try to get, you know, business types and others to visit Salt Lake City and they want to use the transit, that doesn't make much sense to do that. So,
was this expenditure something that wasn't, I guess, anticipated, the big spending as opposed to the study? This is something that was or wasn't anticipated by by UTA or the city, airport up until now?
You know, it sounds like it was anticipated by them, but this is the first time this has really become public. And so, you know, we cover the UTA quite extensively, and this is the first whisper that we've heard of that is in this meeting the other day when they came in and amended their budget to add this $4.2 million item.
You know, you mentioned that Mayor Jackie Biskupski, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, was advocating before the board that they should approve this. She also said that the city would seek other funding to try and help offset costs. What kind of funding would that be?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, a lot of projects you've seen with tracks have involved federal funding. In many cases, the feds have picked up most of the funding. Those days, by and large, have gone behind us now, that those big transit projects are much more rare. There is still federal money to be had, so I'm assuming that's what she's talking about, is that kind of funding. I really don't know what other sources, because at the meeting, they stated that they have no anticipation and have an agreement not to use airline fees that they're using to do the expansion at the airport. They're not going to use that for this transit project.
Okay, so not from passengers coming in and expenses on that. And there have been, that's something that some residents have said should be amended.
George Chapman, who is sort of the resident community activist and UTA critic, said that makes sense. That's where that money should come from. But that was a non-starter with the UTA board.
Well, and UTA has been under, you know, some scrutiny over the past few years for a number of reasons. They vowed to focus more on bus service and on extending hours of service. Is this going to cut into their ability to do that?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that's kind of a key question. And also, you know, Jackie Biskupski, when she ran for mayor, she talked about how Salt Lake City is not well served by UTA. And she was very critical of a plan to put another tracks line in to the university, I think on South Temple. And she talked about the possibility of Salt Lake City starting its own bus service, because that was the way she thought perhaps that we could get a more responsive transit system. This seems to be, you know, going in a very different direction, and I haven't heard the mayor talk much about bus service in Salt Lake City since the election.
Well, as far as this tracks line extension goes, so they're going to consider it. It's not necessarily a done deal yet, but
it's not officially a done deal.
Okay.
I sense that it is a done deal, but that hasn't been approved yet.
Okay. Well, an interesting story, and you can check out the coverage at sltrib.com. Dan, Harry, another story in the Tribune from just a couple of days ago, that Utah is the worst in the nation when it comes to having judges who actually reflect the state's population. Women and minorities underrepresented on the bench more than in any other state.
Yeah, and this study comes out at a very interesting time, which is there's a movement in the legislature to try to do away with any consideration of diversity in picking the judges that are screened, nominate, and then go to the governor for nomination. The argument of some legislators, and leading this charge is Merrill Nelson from Grantsville, is the argument that the only thing that should be considered is the judge's character and qualifications, and you shouldn't look beyond that. You know, people who argue otherwise say, that's ridiculous. You know, people only have trust in the court system when there are people that look like them that are sitting on the bench, that are sitting on juries. And right now, as this study pointed out, 79% of judgeships in the state are occupied by white men. Hmm. And, you know, if I can see if you're a woman prosecutor or if you're a female defendant or defense attorney, you know, and there's that kind of overwhelming presence on the bench that, you know, you start to question the fairness of the system. Same thing with ethnic minorities. Very few ethnic minorities now are sitting on our bench.
So Utah gets a failing grade from this group. Is there a movement afoot to try and amend how judges are selected?
Well, so in just a few months ago, the CCJJ and that handles these judicial screenings agreed under pressure from the legislature to remove this provision on the application that dealt with diversity. But they are now going to try to come back with a rule that goes through, you know, the proper rulemaking procedure to reinstate that onto the questionnaires for applicants. Whether that generates another fight from the legislature, we'll have to see, but it looks like that's likely.
Well, it's an interesting story, and listeners, you can find it at sltrib.com. Government editor Dan Harry, thanks for that. Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this. Give us a call, 801-355-TALK, with your questions. We can take them live on air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. And you can also comment at sltrib.com. You know, we are going to take another short break, but when we return, we will turn to politics with Matt Canham, finally. And we'd love to hear from you. Again, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We'll return in a moment. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
I'm Robin Young. Golf courses are scrambling to react to climate change. In Scotland, they've long been comfortable with choosing grasses that can go brown.
They look as though they've died, but they haven't. They've just gone dormant. They've shut themselves down. You don't play golf on colour, you play golf on grass.
Next time, here and now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we play games in Los Angeles with Jeff Goldblum, Micah Monroe, and Weird Al Yankovic, who mashes David Bowie.
Just watch me sculpt my mashed potatoes. Sculpt my mashed potatoes. I sculpt my mashed potatoes.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Matt Canham, and Jessica Miller. And we are looking at this past week's news in review. Matt Canham, politics. You reported this week that a longtime, far to the right conservative activist in Utah, who also happens to be a Republican delegate, isn't impressed with Donald Trump, the GOP's nominee, and she's hoping to do something about it.
Yes, she's one of many Utah Republican delegates to the National Committee who are not impressed with Donald Trump. All 40 of our delegates are pledged to Texas Senator Ted Cruz, even though he has bowed out of the race. So Donald Trump came in third in Utah as well. But there's a sense there's not much you can do now that he's the presumptive nominee. He has a number of the number of delegates needed that on the first ballot he'll claim the nomination. If the rules stay the way they are now, there's a group of delegates started by a woman in Colorado who want to change the rules and make it so that every delegate can vote any way they want right on the first ballot.
Free the delegates.
Free the delegates is what the name of this is. They're fundraising. They have TV ads. They're having conference calls. And what they ask for is someone to represent every state. Gail Ruzicka is the person representing Utah in this effort. She's the Utah Eagle Forum, the face of the Utah Eagle Forum for decades, a very powerful far-right group, presence at the legislature every single day of the session. Absolutely. And she's one of the Utah's 40 delegates, which a lot of people ran for. It was a big competitive race to see who's going to represent the state in the convention in Cleveland, and she got one of the spots.
And so her, she's joined this group. She wants to change the outcome of what might happen in Cleveland, I guess. I mean, along with so many other people from this organization.
So, yeah, the way it works is all the states have these primaries and these caucuses to determine who's going to be the delegates to go to the convention. But a week before the convention, a select group come and create the rules. And so you can change the game a little bit right before the convention starts. So there's, you know, this group, this rules committee is actually led by Enid Mickelson. She's a former congresswoman from Utah. She's Utah's national Republican committee woman. And she's going to be the one who has to wrangle all these voices and determine what rule changes are going to happen. Mm-hmm. And she's been a little circumspect on this. You know, but she did point out that this is an idea that comes up every single convention to let the delegates do whatever they want. And now that might sound a little extreme. The people like Gail would point out when you elect delegates to go to the county convention or the state convention in Utah, they have the freedom to vote for who they want. It's the national convention where they're bound by the results in each state.
Essentially, because they have to go with the way that the voters told them to go.
Yeah, the idea is the voter said, we wanted Ted Cruz over Donald Trump, and then they're supposed to go there and represent that, and whoever gets the magic number wins the nomination.
Remind us, how does Utah's delegation in Washington view Donald Trump? To compare against this movement.
So Senator Orrin Hatch is the only one who's actually defended Donald Trump. When he made some controversial and racist remarks about a federal judge of Hispanic descent, Orrin Hatch was the one who came out and said, well, he's not really a racist. You know, this is overblown. But then you have someone like Mike Lee, who the other senator from the state, who refuses to talk about Donald Trump, for a long time kept saying that he wants to get more information and now just doesn't want to bring it up. So we don't know how he's voting in November. On the House side, you have Rob Bishop, Jason Chaffetz, and Chris Stewart, who are all grudging supporters of Donald Trump because he's the Republican nominee. But none of them have been effusive in praise here. Mia Love is the last member of our delegation, and she, like Mike Lee, has refused to say.
Well, and has been mentioned by the Washington Post in a random statement as a potential running mate.
So what the Washington Post did is they looked at the field and said there's certain types of people who fit vice presidential molds. You want people who have national defense experience, or you want someone who is a woman or a minority to shake up the balance of the ticket. You want someone from a different geographic sphere. And when they looked at that, they picked 35 people, and Mia Love was one of them. Now, I don't really think that Donald Trump's campaign is reaching out to Mia Love as a vice presidential nominee. But what that signaled is the way that national political reporters view her. They view her as someone who is on a track for a national post. Mm-hmm. Now, she has to survive her reelection campaign, which isn't going as well as she would probably hope at this stage. But that's the track that, at least in the national lens, she's looked at.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving back to this movement to free the delegates and to try and do something at the convention in Cleveland, what does Donald Trump say about this movement and what's he trying to do to maybe thwart it, I guess?
So he's concerned, and he's gone through a range of emotions on this one. He started out by calling it a hoax and that it's illegal. Utah Republican Party Chairman James Evans actually drove down to Vegas or flew down to Vegas and met with him briefly and And James Evans told me that Donald Trump brought this up, that there is concern on how to make that work. And he is now getting together a group of people to lobby delegates to stay home. Hmm. You know, there's been some national polls on this issue, and average Republican voters are still more inclined to keep Donald Trump as their nominee than to change the rules to find someone else. And I think that that's something to keep an eye on. If the party shifts, if the average people are ready to dump him, then it's easier for delegates to make that move. But when you're going against your voters, it's a big, big shift to make.
Not that far off, though, this convention. We'll know, you know, in a month.
Yeah, yeah, a few weeks. And the Salt Lake Tribune will be there.
I want to go back just for a moment to Gail Ruzicka from the Eagle Forum and her role in this. Can you... do we know how other members of the Utah Eagle Forum feel about this? Because you would think that, you could imagine that there would be more of a natural alliance with Trump from that group, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, and I think that's the hard part with an election like this, is that you want to put Donald Trump in a normal political category. He's either a centrist, a Chamber of Commerce Republican, he's one of these far-right conservatives, and he's not any of those things. He's Donald Trump. And when you ask what Gail Ruzicka cares about, it's not the things that Donald Trump talks about all the time. Okay. You know, she said that she was offended by the comments he makes about women and what he said about minorities, and that she wants someone who's consistent in moral viewpoints, which is very important to Utah's Eagle Forum. So his random comments, or not random, excuse me, his shifting comments over time on abortion, he was... more pro-abortion rights early on. In the last 6 or 7 years, he's now talked about how he's against having abortion rights. And so that's something that she doesn't trust him on. He also has been open about infidelity in the past. He's been married a few times. And for someone who's in the Eagle Forum, that's a big no-no. Hmm.
Dan Harry, I want to bring you in on this as well. The Utah has been shown to be overwhelmingly not in favor of Trump as well, to the extent that there have even been some predictions that Hillary Clinton could conceivably win in the November election if she's up against Donald Trump.
Yeah, we had a poll that showed Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump neck and neck in the state. Neither of them are popular. She has like a two-thirds unfavorability in among voters in Utah, and he has very high unfavorability as well. So I think many Utahns are looking at kind of the lesser of two evils thing. Hmm. And you know, one thing that the Republican Party is really worried about here is turnout. They feel that you know, a lot of Republicans will and cannot force themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton, but they instead will just not vote at all. And that worries them because that really affects down the ticket races. And Mia Love is at the top of that list of concerns in the 4th District.
And being vulnerable there. Maybe.
Yeah. And if you have, you know, a significant percentage of Republicans that stay home in that race, that could be the end of her congressional career right there. The same thing with Salt Lake County. Salt Lake County Council right now is controlled by one seat by Republicans. And that's an important and pretty powerful group that, you know, a lot of people don't follow the Salt Lake County Council from week to week. But they have a lot of power. They have a lot of sway. And if the Democrats, who also control the mayorship in Salt Lake County, now control the county council, that really gives them a lot more power that they would like to have.
Mm. Okay, so an effect and a sort of side effect of Trump's running. Matt Canham, another story that you broke this week, and this is whether or not, I guess this is if people show up to vote, Senator Mike Lee would seem to have a big advantage over either of his potential Democratic opponents. This is based on new polling, and of course, you know, transitioning from the story about how Trump might affect down ballot races. This one seems pretty secure, a little bit safer for the Republicans.
Yeah, you could say that. But there's also it's a lower margin than you would expect in such a conservative state. So on Tuesday, the primary election takes place. There's been mail-in ballots for a few weeks. If you still have one of those ballots, you need to postmark it by Monday. You could also vote in person. Check out your county clerk's websites and find the locations on Tuesday. On the Democratic side, there's really one race. and it's to see who's going to challenge Mike Lee. And you have Jonathan Swinton, who's a 35-year-old owner of Marriage Counseling Services, and Misty K. Snow, a transgender woman who is a cashier at grocery stores, at a grocery store. And neither of them have been involved in politics in any sort of major degree until they decided to run for the United States Senate to try to take on Mike Lee. And we don't really know what's going to happen in this race. They're both so unknown that polling has been, you know, they're neck and neck with 60% not knowing what to do.
Right.
So we're not really sure who's going to come out of this. What the Salt Lake Tribune did with its poll with the Hinckley Institute of Politics is instead of doing head-to-head against people that no one know, we tried to see if one would fare better against Mike Lee than the other. And even there, the numbers were about the same. What we found was if Jonathan Swinton, the marriage counselor, would get 39% to Mike Lee's 50, and Misty K. Snow would get 37% to Mike Lee's 51.
Probably within a margin of error in the
between polling. Those two, yes. There's no real benefit. Now, they would say that's a pretty good number. Starting point, when you compare it to past elections and the amount of vote the Democrats have got. And that's true, except that's also massive landslide losses, so you don't really – that doesn't really mean a whole lot.
So they see good signs in it, but obviously Mike Lee's campaign would – I don't know if he would have commented on this, but he would see great signs in this as well, that he is well ahead of either of his potential general election competitors.
Yeah, I haven't felt a sense of concern from the Mike Lee campaign. He has increased his fundraising as you would in an election year. But there hasn't been a change in message. There hasn't been a change in strategy here on the ground in Utah. He is patiently waiting for the calendar to continue to roll before doing some campaign events. The interesting part here is Jonathan Swinton fits much more of the traditional mold of a Democrat candidate. He is a conservative Democrat. He is Mormon. He's a business owner. He fits a lot of what Republicans are used to running against in here. Misty K. Snow would be a little bit of an outlier when it comes to candidates. She'd be the first transgender person to hold a nomination for a major race in Utah. She is an aggressive personality who is not going to pull punches with Mike Lee. Jonathan Swinton talks about wanting to compromise. And Misty K. Snow calls Mike Lee a loathsome person. It would be a much different contest for Mike Lee, depending on who wins this Democratic primary.
It's very interesting. Dan, Harry, how about the idea of maybe a down ballot effect having some sort of impact on this race when it comes to November?
On this race, you know, it's not like the 4th District where it's last time was a close race. Polling shows this one again to be close. Most people are not worried on behalf of Mike Lee that he can become reelected. His worry was a year ago when, you know, powerful individual Scott Anderson, who's the head of the Zions Bank, was trying actively to recruit a Republican challenger for Mike Lee.
Right.
And he did polling, found high-profile people that could give Mike Lee a run for his money. Josh Romney was one of those. And tried to recruit them to run against Mike Lee, and they wouldn't do it. And so now Scott Anderson is, along with John Huntsman, co-chair of the Mike Lee campaign. And so the Republicans have sort of conceded.
How times have
we
changed.
Don't love him, but Mike Lee is our guy, and he's going to be there for another 6 years.
Wow. All right. Well, it's we'll see what happens in November, if it's a sure thing or not. Guys, we have come to the end of the hour, and it's gone by quickly, but we've got to go to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And maybe I'll start with you, Dan Harry. We'll stick with you. What have you got?
Okay, I'm going to go out of my usual realm of politics and talk about education. And we saw a story today about the Alpine School District, which I believe is the largest in the state, saying, you know, there are several school board members who said, the issue of this transgender bathroom issue is so important to us that we would be willing to give up $40 million in federal funding so that we don't have to follow the directives of the Obama administration and allow transgender students to choose which bathroom they use. I mean, that it's kind of, to me, an amazing story when you talk about Utah is already the lowest funded school system in the nation, and we have the largest class sizes. And here's the largest school district in the state that is saying we would be willing to give up $40 million.
What percentage of their budget is that?
I think their budget's around 600 and some odd million dollars. But, you know, it's a significant chunk of money.
Wow.
Far more than we've seen increases in the education budget, which the legislature is, you know, patting itself on the back in recent years. Hmm. And now they haven't approved this yet. They haven't approved to forego that money. But there is a significant number of the school board members who want to do that.
Hmm. Okay. Well, underplayed story of the week there from Dan Harry. Matt Canham, how about yourself? What have you got?
So the Census Bureau came out with new numbers this week, and Utah has surpassed the 400,000 mark for the number of its residents who are Latinos. And that is an interesting benchmark. It's by far Utah's biggest minority group, and they're growing in power and influence. But one of the demographers that our reporter Lee Davidson talked to pointed out that depending on where you live, you might not even notice this trend happening. There's such a segregation of where Utah's Latinos live that you can be in pockets of the state and not realize that one out of every seven Utahns is a Latino.
Wow. New census data from Matt Canham on for his underplayed story of the week. Jessica Miller from, well, it doesn't have to be from your desk. What's your choice for underplayed story?
So I pick a story by Courtney Tanner about Utah's first porn dog.
Oh.
The Weber County Sheriff's Office just acquired a canine. His name is Earl, which is spelled U-R-L, which is great.
Dorky.
And so it doesn't actually sniff out porn, but it finds devices, you know, like thumb drives and things where you might be hiding porn if the police are coming to your house to look for, like, illegal porn. So this dog goes and can sniff out all of those electronic devices.
And if you've just misplaced a thumb drive, can you invite the dog in to try and help you?
I don't know about that.
Okay. That's an interesting one. All right. The state's newest cop on the block from Jessica Miller. For my part, this isn't underplayed, but in all of the Brexit news, the story of a, and this may have gotten lost, the story of a split Supreme Court decision that blocks President Obama's plan that would have shielded undocumented immigrants from deportation. That's my pick for the underplayed story of the week, affecting as many as 5 million people. Matt Canham, Dan Harry, and Jessica Miller, thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks also to reporter Nate Carlisle, who joined us earlier by phone. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Roger.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Kirby talks about gun control. And to start off with, I asked him how many guns he owns.
After I wrote this column where I said that I didn't know how many, I went down and took inventory, and I can find 31.
Is that a collector's passion?
No, it's just junk I've held on to over the years because I was too lazy to sell it.
Well, you write about the need to protect yourself from what you call blithering vacationers, which is why you say you own a buffalo gun. You owned this buffalo gun.
For about 30 years. One of the reasons I like it is the bore's so big you don't have to, you can shoot out of it. You know, you can mold a Starburst candy into a bullet, put some powder behind it, and give your son-in-law a welt across the street.
I take it you've done that.
Yeah, I'm not saying nothing.
Okay. Well, speaking of old-fashioned weaponry, you write about what the framers of the Constitution were envisioning when the Second Amendment was penned. Can you read us a little bit of that part of your column?
Sure. Back when the Constitution was framed, firearms were lethal, but required a cumbersome reloading process between shots. This was fast enough for home defense and hunting, but not so much when everyone else had a musket as well. What if you had to shoot several somebodies back then? Well, tough. The Second Amendment does not say a thing about artillery and or bombs being necessary for home defense. Suddenly, people ask themselves, well, the government has assault weapons. Why can't I have one, too? It's precisely this logic that cuts through the argument. It isn't whether we need gun control, but rather how much we need. We already have some control in place, and it's a good thing, too.
You know, this is a sort of imagined arms race between citizens and the government of the United States. And that shows up a lot in the argument over gun control.
Right. It does show up a lot. In fact, I'm hearing it from people who are writing me back talking about the day when they'll have to take up arms in defense of their liberty. It's real Captain Moroni stuff out of the Book of Mormon.
Hmm. Defense of their liberty. Well, I'm sure that this column has gotten a big response, but I'm curious first, you do come out in favor of gun registration.
Yes, I do. I'm a gun owner, and I don't particularly care for government, really, of any kind. But that's just because I don't like behaving myself. I recognize that it's necessary. And so when I say that I support gun registration, it doesn't mean I want the government taking everybody's guns away from them. I want people to be responsible when they own it. So I wrote in the column, I support gun registration. By this, I mean all guns should be registered with the government. We currently register vehicles, businesses, aircraft, babies, radio stations, voters, boats, animals, and sex offenders. I don't see what the big deal is about registering guns.
So have you gotten phone calls from this column, or did anyone unfriend you on Facebook as a result?
Well, I'm sure I've been unfriended on Facebook. That happens every time I write something that's even close to being controversial. Hmm. But yeah, you hear from people whose passion leads them to read things into this that aren't really there. Some people are so ardent in their desire to possess firearms free of government interference that they make up threats that really aren't there, or they perceive threats that really aren't there.
Do you think that we will see greater registration, greater prohibition even on ownership of certain kinds of weapons anytime soon?
I think it's inevitable. I do. As for soon, I don't know. And as for the people out there who advocate, you know, violent resistance to governments, just remember that half the United States revolted against the other half over 100 years ago, and the bigger half burned their country flat to the ground.
Sherman's March.
So make no mistake about it, you know, militias that are just thrown together don't usually win. And you can argue that they did in the Revolutionary War, and I'll argue straight back, they only did it with the French help. And who are you going to turn to when the government comes after you? You're going to invite Mexico in on your side?
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Public Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Bennett Purser at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. A quick reminder that next Thursday, that's Thursday, June 30th, at the Leonardo, the Salt Lake Tribune is hosting a town hall forum on campus sexual assault, on rape culture on Utah campuses. I'll be moderating that discussion. Great panelists involved and voices from the Tribune's own reporting on this topic. Again, that's next Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Leonardo here on Library Square in downtown Salt Lake City. More information is available at the Tribune's Facebook page. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us today, everybody. Have a great weekend.